Welcome to Pacific Mammal Research's Marine Mammal Highlight Series. We are a 501c3 research and education nonprofit studying marine mammals in the Salish Sea off Washington State. In this series, you will learn about different marine mammals as we discuss interesting facts about each species. This is our way to geek out, share some information, and have some fun. We hope you enjoy the series, and be sure to follow us on Instagram to vote for which animal we talk about next. And without further ado,
welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And this week is our first episode of 2024. Woo-hoo!
Happy New Year!
My hands disappear with my background. Hey
there. You're melding.
Yes, Happy New Year to everybody. Hope you all had a wonderful holiday, however you celebrate, and a good start to the new year. Ours is starting off wet, which is not uncommon in January. And we might have snow later. So my kids, they're like, my daughter's 3 and a half. And she's like, so Christmas is going to be, and there'll be snow. And I was like, that doesn't work here. Yeah, no.
Not every year.
Yeah. Most years. So anyway, we decided to keep our same kind of format doing a marine mammal highlight at the beginning of the month-ish. And then the next episode will be journal reviews and other topics. So we're going to slightly shift kind of what we're doing in those. We will still do some journal reviews, but we're going to pepper in some other cool, like, you know, more recent news that's come out or things like that in those episodes. So keep your ears out for the next one on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, with everything that we're doing on the podcast, please do let us know what you guys want to hear from us. So you can leave a comment, I believe now directly in the episode on Spotify. I think you can actually drop comments directly in there, or you can reach out to us on social media at Pacific Mammal Research. But yeah, we would love to hear from you. Yeah, an email as well. Let us know if there's anything specifically that you want us to talk about or discuss, or that you want to learn more about, because we'd love to do that for you if there's anything specific.
Absolutely. Speaking of just briefly before we get into it, there's a whole mystery on the new J-Pod baby. So it's Jay.
Oh, like whose baby it is?
Yeah, because he's been he's been seen with some different ones, and everybody's like, ooh, whose baby is it? So that was
this is our resident killer whale population, for those of you who are not familiar with the resident killer whales around Washington State. So yeah, very exciting. We'll definitely be, I'm sure we'll be talking about that at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. They have more of an idea of who it is, but still not confirmed as to who this is. So it's kind of fun mystery to be following. So this week, though, this marine mammal highlight is going to be on the spinner dolphins. It was between the spinners and the Atlantic white-sided, and spinners won out not too convincingly, but not a small amount. Mm-hmm. And I think because spinners are cool. I mean, they do that all.
Spinners are super cool.
They're really neat. And actually, we just had one of our volunteers that comes out with us quite often. He was just in Hawaii and actually got to see them out there. So I was super jealous.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. But very, very cool. Like incredible. Yes. Also got some really cool footage of them actually jumping and doing spins and things like that on his phone. So yeah, it was very cool to
Did
see.
Did you get to see it? Did he show you? Oh, he didn't show me.
Well, we had more downtime in the field.
Oh, that's true. Oh yeah. Our day was really, really icky out. It was like raining and stuff. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, next time. Okay. So I digress. So we're going to start off with the what they look like in distribution with Kat. And so here we go.
Yeah. So spinner dolphins, as you might, let's just at the top get it out of the way. Their name obviously comes from their most well-known behavior, which is that when they jump out of the water, they will like to spin multiple times. So Cindy will talk all about that when we get to the behavior. But for right now, let's talk about where they live and what they look like. So these guys are found basically throughout the world in tropical and warm temperate waters. And there are actually 4 subspecies that are recognized currently of spinner dolphins. There is what's known as the Gray's spinner dolphin, which are basically the ones that we're mostly going to talk about because this is the most widespread and the most common. And these include the Hawaiian spinner dolphins that Cindy mentioned at the top. These guys are found in the tropical Atlantic, Indian, and Western and Central Pacific Oceans. Then we have the...
And oh, I'm more so, I think most people are probably, when they think of spinner, they think Hawaii. At least I do.
Yes. Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you've ever seen like pictures of these guys on Google, you're most likely to be seeing pictures from Hawaii. The next subspecies is the Eastern Tropical Pacific Ocean spinner dolphin, which is found off the coasts of South and Central America. Then we have the Central American spinner dolphins, which are found basically in just a very narrow strip of habitat along the west coast of Central America. And then also, which I did not know, there's a dwarf spinner dolphin, which is found in Southeast Asia to Northern Australia. I had no idea that that existed. I was like, four subspecies. I'm like, okay, I can see like two or three, but yeah, there's four. Very cool.
Which is so, all these things are going through my brain of like pictures of what I think these things might look like, but spinners are, as you're going to talk about, they're really long.
They're
like
not
they
big.
Long beaks. And so to have the long thing that's now shorter.
Shorter? I know. I know. So cool. Also, I also found that there is a large population of what are called white belly spinner dolphins, which they think are actually a hybrid form of the grays, which are the most common ones, and eastern spinners. And so this may actually now be confirmed as a fifth subspecies, but that's in conversation right now as to whether or not they should be considered a separate one.
Yeah, it's going to take a while. It takes a while to hash out when a new, especially like a new species or new subspecies is agreed upon.
Yeah. So basically, again, like I said, they're actually fairly widespread. But as I said, mostly what we're going to talk about here today are in reference to those gray spinner dolphins, which are the most common type. So these guys are typically more pelagic, meaning they are found in deeper water. And this is typically where they hunt and track their prey. So Cindy will talk all about that when we get to the diet and behavior section. The reason that many of us know about spinners because they live in Hawaii is because there is a more coastal stock in Hawaii that actually spends more time around the shoreline. So these are the ones that people are often interacting with. It makes it much more easy to get footage of them, to study them, et cetera, because they're closer into shore. And these guys do have basically, and I'm sure Cindy will talk about their behavior in terms of how they utilize that environment. So I'm not going to go too much into that because that goes more into their diet and behavior.
Otherwise, I won't have anything to talk about.
Perfect. Okay, so I'll leave that to you. But yeah, basically, we'll come back to that and circle back to how they utilize that environment. But just know that mostly these guys are more oceanic, but there is this group that sticks more around the coast in Hawaii, which is why we actually know a little bit more about them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in terms of what they look like, typically these guys are actually one of the smaller oceanic dolphin species. So typically oceanic dolphins are a little bit bigger and heftier because they're out in the open ocean. These guys are only about 6.5 feet in length, and they're actually very slender and svelte when it comes to dolphins. So everything, like Cindy said, everything's kind of long and narrow with these guys. So they have a long, narrow beak. They have kind of, you know, not super long flippers, but they're kind of more narrow and curved. Like I said, they reach about 6.5 feet. Typically, the males tend to be a little bit longer than the females. Weights of up to 180 in terms of pounds. I believe it's anywhere between about 100 to 165 pounds is standard. I think the most heavy was like 180 pounds.
Yeah, that's not very big. Like,
in
comparison, if you look at a bottlenose dolphin that's oceanic versus coastal, like the oceanic guys are like close to 1,000 pounds, and they're
heavy.
They're huge and they're chunky, and so that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So like I said, very small and slender compared to a lot of their other dolphin species that would be living in this type of environment. Mm-hmm. In terms of their coloration actually does vary quite a bit across the globe, depending on the region and the subspecies. But in general, they have dark gray backs, white bellies, and like I said, those thin kind of curved flippers. Their dorsal fins will range from kind of what you might think of as a typical dolphin dorsal fin, what we call falcate or curved, to more triangular. And I believe the Eastern Tropical Pacific subspecies tend to have more of that triangular, almost forward sloping fin. So it's almost more like a doll's porpoise type fin, where it almost looks like it was put on backwards a little bit. And those guys, the Eastern Tropical Pacific subspecies, tend to be more dark gray overall. Their white underbelly is less pronounced. The gray spinner dolphin subspecies, which again are those Hawaiian guys, those are more what they call, have like a tripartite color pattern is what it's called. So basically it's three different color patterns. So it's again, that white underbody, a light gray side, and then a much darker gray dorsal or back area. So they're very pretty. If you've never seen them, definitely go Google some pictures. They're very attractive looking. Like I said, the most well-known feature, really, aside from their behavior, is that long,
Really
slender
long.
rostrum.
It's really long.
Very long beak, very long beak compared to a lot of other dolphin species. So,
Yeah.
yeah, so that is what I have for where these guys like to hang out and what they look like.
All right. And if you're watching on YouTube, of course, you'll see the picture of the spinner dolphin there. But if you're just listening, go check him out on your website of choice. Right. So for diet and behavior, it's interesting because all right, so their behavior is very tied to their food, which is true for pretty much every species, but these guys a little bit more in how they split up their day resting and foraging. So they are basically nocturnal feeders. They tend to go out in the late afternoon at dusk and go feed at night. They feed on small fish, shrimp, and squid. And I did see one that there was some crustaceans thrown in there. So I think they've got a fairly varied diet. But their prey is found, they can dive pretty deep. The prey is found around 650 to 1,000 feet depth, which is, again, why Kat was saying mainly oceanic, right? The majority of their time and their needs are met in the oceanic portion of the deeper waters. They follow what's called the deep scattering layer, which is this really cool layer of organisms that basically do a vertical migration where they stay down deep in the daytime to avoid predators, and then they come up at night to feed on the plankton and things like that that are up there. So these ones actually will follow that vertical migration and a horizontal one. So they're deep in the water in the daytime, and then in shallow water or shallower water and more inshore waters at night. So yeah, so particularly for the groups that aren't in the oceanic, the ones that are like Hawaii that are more coastal or inshore, they maybe don't have to go quite as far out to go get their food because it might come in a bit. So that's that their whole lives are centered around going out to feed at night and then coming back in to these areas to rest. And really, most of the behavior that we're going to talk about is their resting behavior, because as Kat said, that's kind of when you see them. They're closer to shore. It's easier to observe and see what they do. So in terms of group sizes, the kind of more coastal areas and closer to shore, generally smaller groups, they can be anywhere from under 50 to you get to those oceanic populations, and it's gonna be thousands. I mean, this is the ones where you see pictures and it's like bubbling or frothing with dolphins, like
So
huge.
cool.
I know, I
Life
still,
goals. Life
right?
goals to see one of those like massive aggregations of spinners. I think that'd be
Yep.
so cool.
Bucket list for sure.
Yeah.
So they can range in that depending on kind of the population. And I'll be mentioning that too, is that as all the different subspecies you talked about, and with even within the subspecies, the different habitats or populations that they have will vary in terms of social structure and exactly what the group sizing looks like. So the social structure does vary by population, and it can go anywhere from being very stable pods that basically hang out just all together and that's it, to very fluid fission fusion, changing groups throughout the day and having. I didn't look into this too deeply, but because I don't think we actually know too much about the hardcore social structure of those big, large oceanic groups for various reasons, including taking pictures of all those animals and being able to determine who's hanging out with who in a group of 1,000. So it's possible that they have some long-term relationships, but it is ones that they're kind of changing in and out most of the day. The nearshore form, or the nearshore animals generally form those smaller, more stable groups, and that's kind of consistent with in many different species. Coastal groupings just to be like, it's nicer to be in smaller groups, and not as much space probably to be able to be in larger groups. So when they're not feeding, and then basically they feed through the night, and then in the morning they're like, "Ooh, I'm so tired. Let's get some rest." And so they will rest in open sandy bottom areas where predators are more visible. And this includes protected bays, which is why we know so much about the ones in Hawaii, because that's what they're doing. They're going into those protected bays and just basically hanging out and sleeping and resting and just kind of
Chilling.
chill, yeah, milling, chilling, Exactly. And so when they're resting, they rely on vision, not echolocation. So they're actually generally more quiet then. So again, those clear waters where you can see the bottom and you can go, yep, there's no sharks there. Check. Got it.
We're
Excellent.
safe.
Yeah, exactly. So when they are resting, they will move back and forth slowly in single unit, on a single unit with tight formation, but spaced out just out of contact with each other. So it's like, I want to be close to you, but I don't want to touch you. Like, those are the rules. But
Interesting.
I
I
could touch
relate.
you if I
I
wanted
relate.
to, but I don't. So yeah. They rest about 4 to 5 hours a day. And that this can shift seasonally as the day length changes. So they will change as the seasons go with how much daylight there is and whatnot.
Interesting.
Which probably has less of an issue since a lot of them are in the trop, the at least the ones in the tropics, the daylight amount of is not really going to
Pretty
change as much. Yeah.
consistent. Yeah.
But regardless, they do change with that. After they rest, they abruptly increase their activity level. So it's almost just like, and oh, time to forage. They will increase their swim speeds. They'll do more aerial behaviors. They'll do vocalizations and make shorter dives than when resting. So they're kind of amping up to get ready to go out to go feed. A 1994 study showed a zigzag pattern that was observed where they'd swim to open water, double back, and come back into the shallow, and then repeat. And they just keep doing that. It's like zigzag, zigzag, zigzag. And they thought it was possibly a social cue for getting the entire group to coordinate and like, hey, let's get everybody together. Let's go
Right.
head out.
This is your cue. Now we're going to get ready to go and feed. And interesting. Yeah.
Exactly. And it makes sense because in the little more open ocean, you don't see the bottom. There's a lot more predators. So being in a larger group is going to be safer,
Yeah.
just in general.
Especially for these guys. 'Cause like we said, they're not big animals. Like these are not, these are not
They're not
hefty
beefcakes
beings.
going out there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the acoustic patterns rise and fall with that zigzag pattern. And then when they subside, the dolphins swiftly race off to the offshore waters and foraging grounds. So it's like this kind of ritual, maybe, to some degree of
I was
like,
thinking of almost like a pep rally, right? Where
yeah.
it's almost like, all right, let's get you all psyched up and ready to go. We're letting you know that it's about to happen. And then, all right, and go.
Maybe there's some cheerleaders in the dolphin groups that wants to
That's
start.
what I'm not gonna lie. I
Yeah.
was thinking about that.
Yeah, and get little pom-poms and they go getting everybody ready. Love it.
I can see it.
So they sometimes are joined by bottlenose or spotted dolphins, depending on the population when they go out. And then the dive times will extend into as the foraging begins, so they have to dive deeper to go get their prey. So that's their main life, right? They are also very social and playful. So they are very common, will bow ride, they will leap, they will spin, obviously, they do backflops, they're acrobatics, sometimes they play with trash, which is a problem. But they are social in that aspect of just, the very characteristic dolphin having a great time, spinners do that well. What's really cool, and this is where I'm going to talk about their spinning behavior, they can fully spin along their body length up to 7 times in one loop.
So that's literally like seven full
Seven rotations.
rotations in the air, just for those of you who are trying to picture that. Nuts.
Right. And like, okay, sure. And so what happens is they start to spin just before emerging head first in the water. And then they leap up to 3 meters into the air and they spin continuously before falling back into the sea. The big question is why? Well, there's lots of speculation. Much of it occurs after rest time. So it may be part of that cheerleading pep rally, right? The cheerleaders flipping, each other in the air to get everybody excited. Could be a work. Some of the one of them was a workout. So if they've been resting all day, they got to get those muscles up and going.
Oh, like a warm up. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Could be for courtship. It could be like, look how many spins I can do and how high I can fly. Not uncommon. And also removing parasites. So a lot of times breaching in general is thought to be dislodging parasites like remoras, which are these super creepy little fish that have a modified dorsal fin and they're upside down on the dolphin. And their modified dorsal fin is a suction cup that holds them to the dolphin or shark or turtle or whatever it is. Yeah, they're creepy. I've seen many of them in my time in the Bahamas. So it's possible that, and I'll put a pin in that for a second because we'll go back to that in just a minute when I go over the details. And so one starts, others join in. So again, it's like that pep rally. Like one starts to go, and everybody's like, yeah, let's do it. So there's clearly a social, communicative, likely playful. It may just be freaking fun too. So, you know, that social aspect. And what's interesting is the Hawaii spotted dolphins and the climbing dolphins both spin, but no other species do.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the Hawaii spotted dolphins, apparently from one resource, could jump higher than the spinners. But
oh, yeah. Wow.
So
competition.
Yeah. Who knew? So I had this in my new research, but it's not really new. It's 2006. So crazily, that's almost 20 years old, which boggles my mind. But since this is on the dynamics of the aerial maneuvers, I thought I'd pepper this in here. It was previously thought that the twisting of the body while airborne was the mechanism of how they did it. So they jumped out and then started twisting. But their morphology basically means that, like, it can't happen. Like, their body can't do that. They don't have the muscle to do that. So they used a mathematical model that demonstrates that the angular momentum to induce the spin, so the momentum they need to do it, was generated underwater prior to the leap. So that's what I'm saying. They start spinning.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And then so just the propulsion keeps them going, kind of.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And I'm going to read this verbatim because it's a little bit thick. I won't do as good a job of condensing it. So the subsurface corkscrew motion is a balance between drive torques generated by the flukes, so the fluke pushing, and by hydrodynamic forces at the pectoral fins. So it's a combo, right? They're forcing with their flukes and they're, you know, turning with their pectoral fins. And the resistive torques induced by the drag forces acting on the rotating control surfaces. So yeah, I think it's the resistance in the water, right? So there's torque in each direction. So they're using that to help start it. As the dolphin leaps clear of the water, this balance is no longer maintained as the density of the air is essentially non-existent and a net drive torque remains. So they're pushing, they're pushing against something that's resisting it. And then they get into the air and it's like,
yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I think it's almost like a fishing line where you're like rolling it in and it's pulling out against resistance. But if you let it go, it'll just zip. Right.
Yeah.
So now this permits the dolphin rotation speed to increase as much as a factor of 3 from a typical rotation.
So it's, wow. So interesting.
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating. I saw this one. I was like, it's not new, but we have to do it because it's about how they do this cool spinning. So the high rotation rates and orientation of the dolphin body on re-entry into the water could produce enough force to hydrodynamically dislodge unwanted remoras.
Right. Got it. So that is a valid theory, potentially, that might be why they're doing it to some degree.
Yeah, you could actually, because I mean, that's the other thing, because I've seen remoras. I've seen dolphins try to take remoras off. I've seen people try to take remoras off. That is not easy. So I was like, I don't know if that can really dislodge them, really. I mean, but apparently that spinning can.
Interesting. So, yeah, very cool.
It was very cool. So the last thing, just reproduction, their lifespan is about 20, 25 years, which is younger than most dolphin species, live closer to 50. So I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. I know, me too. I was curious about that one too, because how much do we know over a long period of time about how long they live, you know, but who knows? Yeah.
Yeah. And they're sexually mature at 7, which is similar to most other dolphin species that live till 50. So like they have a lot of reproductive years in there because their interbirth interval is also about 3 years. It's the same as many dolphin species that live to 50. So they lactate for 1 to 2 years. Again, very similar to the dolphins. They just don't live as long apparently. What was really interesting is that, so their gestation is 11 months, fairly typical. But they mate year round and actually mate. Like, it's not just mating behavior. It's they mate year round and they calve year round. So they can have babies whenever.
Interesting. Which, I mean, I guess because they mostly live in tropical waters, they're not restricted by temperature per se. Mm-hmm. And if they have access to food year round.
But then
I guess there's no reason.
Bahamas, they are in warm waters with, you know, theoretically food all year round, and they have a peak interval. They, you know, they calf during the early,
but they have to deal with like hurricanes.
Yeah. But hurricanes are during the summer when the babies are born.
True. Yeah, interesting. Because
So.
that's, yeah, like you said, that's pretty unusual. I mean, other species like harbor porpoise will mate year round, but they typically do still have a peak birthing period. It's not like they're giving birth year round.
Yeah, and I think most have that. Like they may do the
Yeah.
behavior around year round, but the actual conception only happens at, one or two times during the year. So yeah.
Very interesting.
And multiple males mate with one female, and it's the same as all dolphins. They're very randy little guys to mate with each other. So yeah, that's it for my diet and behavior and spinning extravaganza that we have here for the spinner dolphins. So before we get into the threats and new research and things, we will take a quick break and be right back.
Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the Research Director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy.
All right, we're back. So there, you'll notice in this section that there's a lot about human interaction between the research and the threats that Kat will be talking about. And again, we'll just harp back to that. Many of these are in that more coastal area. They are going to be more more interaction with humans and therefore more issues that are related to that. So I will let Kat take it away.
Yeah, so let's start off with where we're at with population numbers for these guys. And basically, I couldn't find a good estimate, which again, kind of makes sense because they are actually fairly widespread around the world. And we don't, again, because they're mostly out in the open ocean, we don't have a lot of good data for monitoring population sizes. However, one of the more recent population counts I could get for the Hawaiian Gray's spinner dolphins was about 3,000 individuals. That was back in 2002. So again, that's still quite an old estimate. But it seems like they're somewhere around there-ish. The Eastern Tropical Pacific subspecies is estimated at about 400,000, and that's down 80% from an estimated 2 million animals that was estimated from 20 years ago. And we'll get to why in just a second.
I think I know why. I'll wait.
Yeah, that, but that's again,
wow.
Like this is
that's huge.
Pretty insane drop in numbers.
And I was like,
so
400,000, that sounds like a lot of animals.
Right? Yeah, I know. So overall, the spinner dolphin is listed as data deficient by the IUCN because, again, we just don't know enough about them to have a good handle on numbers. However, the Eastern tropical spinner dolphin is categorized as vulnerable. So that one subspecies has a different listing because we do know that there was such massive depletion that we do need to be a little concerned about those guys. Like most other marine mammals, they are protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act throughout their range. So what are we protecting them from? Let's get into it. So first off, let's talk about bycatch, because that is the main reason why those Eastern tropical spinner dolphins are massively depleted. So like we said, these guys are mostly living in the oceanic environment. Spinner dolphins, again, because they're a smaller size animal and they're quick and agile, they're actually at high risk of bycatch from deep sea fisheries, particularly the tuna fishery. So so those Eastern tropical spinner subspecies, those guys were depleted basically almost 100% by the tuna fishery industry. So that's
that
a depletion of
have,
potentially 80%.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are the poster species of why we have dolphin safe tuna. Right?
Correct. Yeah. And so they're very susceptible to drift nets and gill nets, which again, kind of just encompass everything and then pull tight at the top and then drag the catch in. So they can't escape. If they get caught in that net, they can't jump out. So that's a huge one. Again, there have been various steps taken in the last, about 10 years or so to reduce bycatch of dolphins, specifically in these fishing industries like dolphin safe tuna, line caught tuna. If you're going to buy tuna at all, just a little blurb, please get line caught tuna, because that the problem is a lot, even the dolphin safe tuna, actually, those methodologies can increase bycatch of other species, such as sharks and other bottom dwelling fish species. So it's
Interesting.
beneficial for dolphins, but it's not always actually the most beneficial for the marine environment.
And it's also not completely dolphin safe. Like dolphin safe means there's
No.
a lower limit as to how many got caught in the process.
Correct. So if you're going to buy tuna at all, line caught tuna, where they're basically like angle fishing for a tuna, is the best way to go. Just a little plug. So bycatch is a big one. Human interactions and viewing. We're going to spend a little more time on this one because this is a lot of what Cindy was alluding to here. So, as we said, there's a huge marine mammal watch industry in Hawaii for the spinner dolphins because they come so close to shore, because they're in these, very nice, comfortable coastal bays and close in shorelines that people can easily reach and access. That's been an increasing tourism and recreational activity over the past several decades. So, when I was looking on the NOAA website, they estimated that there's more than 70 different tour operators that provide dolphin-directed tours that are focused on the Hawaiian spinner dolphins. So that's over 70 different operators. And that was, I'm not quite sure when that was from. So that likely is different over the last 5 years or so, but it's a lot of different operators. More than 100 commercial boat tour or kayak tour operations can opportunistically view these animals in the Hawaiian Islands. Again, some of those are specifically encouraging an expectation to have close interaction with those dolphins, whether that is swimming with or just observing. So again, they're intentionally getting really close to these guys.
And I would put a PSA in there about that is that when you if you go out and do dolphin watching or whale watching stuff, like read the website. If they are actively saying like you are going to get close to this animal or that we guarantee this or we do this, that's a red flag because they're not following the regulations that they're supposed to and they're not taking the animal's interests at heart. A lot of the good ones will have say like, look, this is wild animals. We fully go with all the rules and regulations, that you're not guaranteed to get, go up and pet a dolphin, which you should never do. But like even getting close with, that close with a boat. So just keep an eye on those, the way they word things in on the website to pick your best one.
Yeah, and literally the le next line of my notes was this contradicts established wildlife viewing guidelines. So like that's the thing. So they're actively promoting that, and that is in direct contradiction to what they are supposed to do. Again, like Cindy mentioned, a lot of what these animals are doing when they are close into shore is resting, and that's hugely, hugely important for not only their energetic levels, but their overall fitness and their life history, basically their ability to do everything else that they need to do. Response to interactions and viewing, of course, varies with different animals and individuals, but we do know that it can divert time and energy from things like resting and recuperating, even socializing and doing those natural behaviors that they do with one another to maintain social bonds. So again, these can have long-term effects. These can also have direct ramifications in the moment. They also have found with doing a little bit more research into this industry in Hawaii, that there are increased displays from individuals when they are approached by vessels and swimmers, increase in avoidance behaviors by certain animals, and also increase in aggressive behavior directed towards people. So they don't necessarily love being bothered, is what they're finding.
Well, it's like you're sleeping. You know, people come up being like, "Hey, how are you? Oh my God, you look so cute! Like, hey, what are you doing up?"
Right. And again, this is where we talk, this is where it really gets into the volume part of this, where if it's like a boat or a swimmer, that's much less likely to bother them than 70 different boats showing up and swarming around you while you're trying to rest with your family.
And just chronic, like, and I'll talk about that. Much of the new research that I have centers around this stuff, but that chronic level of exposure is a problem. It's not just the one individual, it's this happening all the time.
Consistency. Right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, a lot of the researchers have documented changes to their behavior patterns in some of the daytime habits that they have specifically, and in those essential habitats that they're using consistently as well. Because obviously, if the tour operators know they go to a specific area, it's almost a guarantee you're going to see dolphins. They're going to go there, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of a big and unfolding problem for these guys. Leading on from that, the next threat that I have is additional harassment and illegal feeding. So again, this is more likely to be from recreational individuals versus necessarily with professional tours, but there has been an increase in illegal feeding of these animals. Again, we've talked about this before on other podcasts. This might seem harmless, but this is real. Like, you should never, ever feed wild animals. Please, please, please. Like, this is not something to encourage. This is not something to do, especially with marine mammals, because this can encourage those animals to start approaching boats, which can increase the likelihood of boat strikes and death, and also injury from other individuals who don't want them by their boat, like fishermen, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. This can also impede and discourage normal foraging behavior. So if they know they're going to get provisioned by a human, and that's a lot easier than going out and doing active foraging at night, this can actually start to disrupt their normal behavior patterns and really reduce their ability to be self-sufficient in the wild.
And if you want to learn more about that, if you either go to the Sarasota Dolphin Research Program or the Shark Bay in Australia, both of them have this highly documented negative impacts on animals that beg, you know, at boats, that's in Sarasota, and then the provision dolphins in Shark Bay that change their habitat. We talked about that on another podcast. So it's very evident that it's not a good thing to do.
Correct.
For the animals.
Correct. Next one, which again relates to people, is entanglement and ingestion of marine debris. So again, like Cindy mentioned, they will play with trash. And there has been quite a bit of newer research that suggests that they are ingesting microplastics along with most other marine species, unfortunately.
All species? We are too.
Yep. But again, you know, this is often coming from their prey. So the prey are consuming those particles, and then that goes into the animals that are eating those prey.
Right.
So again, especially around, you know, big tourist centers like Hawaii, there is likely to be a lot more marine debris and trash just because there's more people out on the water. You're by a coastal, well-populated island archipelago. So that's something else that we are contributing to in a negative sense for these guys, potentially. The next one would be anthropogenic noise. So this is human-caused noise. This one's a little bit more general. Like most other cetacean and marine mammal species, these guys, like Cindy said, use sound to communicate, to sense their environment, to navigate, to find food. Obviously, if you're being exposed to increased noise levels from vessels, from oil and gas exploration, offshore development, that can all interfere with those basic everyday tasks that they need to do to survive. So again, you know, this is both immediate issues. If the sound is loud enough, that can cause physical damage to their hearing. This can also be more long-term chronic effects by disrupting those behaviors, changing where they go to find food, et cetera, and actually inhibiting their ability to really thrive in their environment. And the last one, there's quite a long list of threats for these guys. The last one is disease, which again is to some degree human related. So outbreaks of disease in spinner dolphins are not super common as far as we know, but they have been tracking more serious disease outbreaks over recent years, such as things like toxoplasmosis and cetacean morbillivirus in spinner dolphin populations. So the number of deaths associated with these diseases in spinners is thought to be fairly low, although of course there are many that go unreported. But we do know that thousands of other marine mammal species die from these diseases worldwide every year. So this is something that's kind of one that we're watching over time to see exactly how this begins to impact their populations. But we have detected serious disease in spinner dolphins as well. So
well, again,
it's kind of an ongoing one.
Coastal, you know, we've seen another species like porpoises up here that having the antibiotic resistant bacteria, you know, that being closer to the coast is not good for that kind of.
Yeah, you get exposed to a lot more runoff from human and environments, which can lead to increase of those diseases in the population. So, exactly. And again, unfortunately for these guys, because they do aggregate in large groups, it can potentially be easier to transmit diseases once you're in those groups too. So one to watch over time. We'll see where that develops.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to talk about some new research, which again, I said, like a lot of the newer research is looking at the tourism and how that interacts with them and their behaviors. So that's kind of where we're just going to situate ourselves. The first one that I have is actually, it's by Tyne et al. 2015. It's Importance of Spinner Dolphin Resting Habitat. And so this was interesting. They looked at the habitat differences, the habitat features of the resting areas to see, and they use models in here. They looked at inside and outside bays because they do, in other places, they will rest not in bays. Like there's mm-hmm. places. But the big end product here was that if resting dolphins are displaced from resting bays or where they're resting, they are unlikely to engage in resting behavior elsewhere. So if there's
interesting.
Yeah, if they're pooched out, that's it. They don't rest. So it's like you don't go back to sleep. So this emphasizes the importance of those bays, of course, where, as we've discussed, where human influence is very strong. And I believe there are more regulations being set. I think it's illegal actually to swim with them in Hawaii, like more so than just the Marine Mammal Protection Act. I think they've actually gotten some stronger regulations there. That's an important thing to know, right? That it's like, oh, well, they'll just go rest somewhere else. No, they won't. They like that area for that particular reason, and they can't just choose a different one.
So yeah, the level of disturbance is much higher for them. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So the next one was Fumagalli et al. At 2018. This is behavior responses to human activity. This is in Egypt. So they looked at a control site, which didn't have too much, any tourism, I think, and two different tourist sites. And basically they found that dolphin rest was disrupted, especially when unregulated. One site was more, was regulated and the other one was completely unregulated. Like you just free for all, go do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the protection measures at the other site did reduce the disturbance. And so they highlighted the need to adopt precautionary approaches in research and management of whale and dolphin watching, right? So it's the idea of if we don't know how it's going to affect them, maybe we should do less, right? So don't just start doing things and then figure out what went wrong afterwards. Let's be precautionary and say like, well, they probably need this time, so let's stay farther away. Let's reduce the number. Let's, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, Tyne et al. 2018. This is looking at chronic exposure to human activities. So this was interesting. They did one. I believe this was in Hawaii. They looked at one of the bays, and they were exposed to human activities within 100 meters, 82.7% of the day.
Wow, that's wild.
And the different events, the median time frame between them was 10 minutes.
Oh so my gosh.
Every 10 minutes, somebody's coming up and talking to you, looking at you, you know, whatever.
Right. Yeah. Wow. It's almost like being in a zoo, except you're in the wild, you know, in terms of the level of observation and proximity and disturbance
and could even get closer than they do in a zoo.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there's no protection between them and the other people.
Oh, that's insane.
Yeah. And so they found individuals spent an average of 61.7% time resting, with more than 90% of that time being in sheltered bays. So again, these sheltered bays are not places that we should really go in and do a lot of whale watching in, because we're disturbing that time and they don't get it. Like imagine if you're sleep deprived, what happens? You can't forage, you can't behave correctly. I barely get it. I have a new puppy and my kids, and so my sleep level is lower. So it's more difficult to.
And you function way better than I do when I don't get like a full 8 hours of sleep. I'm like, you don't want to be around me if I got 6 hours of sleep. Like it's not good.
Right. And so that plays into those individual differences. Some animals are going to be able to be okay with it and other ones aren't. And you know, that plays into the whole social aspect of it as well. Mm-hmm. What's interesting though, is that they found no observed effect of the exposure on dolphin resting behavior. So it didn't seem like it affected them, but those short intervals probably meant that you couldn't return to a normal resting state. So whatever control observations were saying, like, this is when there wasn't anybody around, are not actually control of actual resting. It's the more, how do they phrase it? The more vigilant nature of resting. Like, so you can have like, I'm asleep. I'm like, nothing's, yeah, I'm good. And I'm not worried about anything. Then there's like, I'm sleeping.
Right, like light.
Right, a light sleep. I'm still vigilant about what's going on. So they never get that true rest that they need because it's just constant.
Wow.
Right?
Interesting.
Yeah. So this can lead to rest deprivation, which, as Kat said, can affect acutely and obtusely, you know, all aspects of their behavior and survival.
Hmm.
I thought that was fascinating. That one.
That's really, really interesting.
Yeah. It also shows that, you know, just because it's a negative, like, oh, there was no effect, doesn't mean there actually wasn't an effect. You have to look at why, you know, why that's happening. This one is Stack et al. 2020 and also McGilliatt and Lammers 2021. They both kind of did similar work on Maui Nui, N-U-I, I'm not sure exactly, but Maui, I believe. They're saying that this is movement and behavioral patterns. So most research is focused on the Big Island, so the population that lives out there, but there are different populations around the different islands. So they wanted to look at Maui. So they found two hotspots of activity on West Maui and South Lanai, and they utilized a variety of habitats. They found, this is a study that was done from 1996 to 2019, so very long amount of time.
Cool.
They found mainly travel with very little resting behavior, which was interesting. They did find the near shore of Lanai and the channels between the islands, which is weird because that seems to be the only dolphins that do that are the only spinners that rest in the channels. No one else, they go to the bays, they go to the other things, but these guys use the channels between the islands. And so that's very different from the Hawaii and Oahu habitat populations.
Mm-hmm.
They found no resting along the coastline of Maui. They did compare, the one study did compare acoustic activity to a regular resting bay in Oahu, and found that the acoustic activity was higher in Oahu than at other Maui sites, which again makes sense if they're not resting kind of in the same way. So they were highlighting for regulations that there apparently is a one closed area in South Maui that they have for protecting these animals, but that's inadequate for providing protection during resting hours because they don't act like everybody else does or the other populations. Mm-hmm. And then there was a 50 meter rule that was implemented for, you know, you have to stay 50 meters away from these animals. And that does seem to be a better way to regulate than time area closures that are done in other locations because they just use a variety of different habitats, including coastlines and channels that are not bays. Mm-hmm. So highlighted the importance of understanding each and individual population and how they use the area. It's not a blanket statement that this is going to work for everybody.
Right. Again, yeah, like you said, it's so important to understand how those individual population units are functioning.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
And there's so much difference in habitat in the Hawaiian archipelago and any island chains. Like there's it's not the same everywhere by any means. Mm-hmm. So the last one I have is Letessier et al. 2022, so the most recent one. This is spinner residency in tropical atoll lagoons, which atolls are so cool, the way they look. It's super fun. But they found that this is in the Maldives.
Maldives.
Maldives. Oh, man, see, I was going to say it the right way, and then I didn't. Maldives. and Chagos, C-H-A-G-O-S. I haven't heard of that one before.
Fine.
Archipelagos. The spinner dolphins are the most widely distributed and numerically abundant cetacean in atolls, using both visual and passive acoustics.
Hmm.
They have the same day-night pattern as all the other spinners. They did find that there was no acoustic detection of the animals following the reversal of monsoon winds, so when the winds shift. And this suggests short to medium residency in the atolls of these dolphins is sensitive to seasonal fluctuations in productivity dynamics. So again, there, as we said earlier, changes in season do tend to affect how they behave in the resting areas. But this is what I was wanting to leave on this one because it talks about basically about poop. And so I thought it'd be a fun one to end on. But they estimate that a pod will deposit 288 kilograms per year of nitrogen in the lagoons. And that nitrogen,
Wow.
yeah, is coming from the mesopelagic, so the middle, deeper water areas where they're feeding, right? And so they're basically transferring the nutrients, those highly productive, highly
Productive.
productive, there we go, productive areas, and taking those nutrients and putting it into a place where there's less, like the, coral reefs and stuff are basically oligotrophic. Like, you don't have a lot of nutrients there. You have to move it from one area of the ocean to the other. And so that's what these guys are doing. They're basically taking that and then pooping in the atolls, and that's fertilizing. So it enhances coral reef productivity and resilience, and suggests that the dolphins play a role in making pelagic energy and nutrients available to the coral reefs that need it.
Wow.
Yeah.
They're like little gardeners without being gardeners.
Exactly.
That's
Exactly. And
so
it's just
cool.
emphasizes poop is important, and that those nutrient movements are important. So it's like it's the predator and prey, like taking the wolves out and the trees die in Yellowstone, right? You take the spinners out of here and the corals die because, possibly because that's where they're getting their nutrients from. So
Yeah. Wow.
super
That's really
important.
cool.
I know. I was like, oh, okay, residency in tropical lagoons. Okay, well, I'll talk about it. And they're like, oh my God, that's so cool. They talked about poop. And how that's important, but I think it emphasizes again that idea of ecosystem level, and everything's connected, and it's all important. You take one thing out and it can mess up something you didn't think was connected at all, because it is.
Yeah,
So
for sure.
with that, I will leave you with spinner poop, feeding corals and making beautiful atolls that we and then we
A
get
good
to
image to
enjoy.
leave on. I like it.
Right, I love it. So that's it for the spinner dolphins. I hope you enjoyed as much as we enjoyed researching it, and we always love learning about the different variety of species we have here in the world. And next time, again, we will be doing either a journal review or hot topic of discussion. I think we actually have one already set out for ourselves, but I'm not going to tell you what it is because I want you to come and listen to it. With that, we will leave you, but don't forget to check out our new merch. We have we got some new hoodies and hats and stuff on our gift shop page.
Super
And
comfy.
yes, they're very soft. And so that's a great way to support. You can subscribe to the podcast. That helps support us too. And any donations are welcome, as we are a small nonprofit, and everything goes back into doing the research and education, like things like this for you guys. And we would like to put a shout out to all that donated in our annual fundraiser at the end of the year. Super grateful to all of you. It's your donations and support. We can't do it without you guys. So thank you so much for seeing the value in our work and helping us get all the cool new information that we're getting out about porpoises and seals, here in the Salish Sea. So with that, unless you have anything else to add, Kat?
Nope, that was it. Thank
No.
you. Thank you.
All right. Well, we will then have a great couple of weeks, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To learn more about the species we discuss, check out our blog. Head to our website, www.pacmam.org, that's PACMAM.org, to check it out. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.